Good evening, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. It's a pleasure to be here. I love being at AA conferences, meetings, anniversaries, anything to celebrate sobriety and Alcoholics Anonymous. I came into AA on Pearl Harbor Day, 1964. So my anniversary day is December 7th, 1964. And I'm one of the lucky ones. I haven't been drunk since my first meeting. And in my personal opinion, I owe it all to not drinking. That is 100% why I haven't been drunk. So if you're new, you've been having a problem, I would check your drinking. Now, somewhere around 3 months in AA, I got happy with not drinking. And I swore that that would never happen. I couldn't conceive of it. And to me, that's what sobriety is. It's Saturday night, and I'm looking forward to not drinking. I'm looking forward to be happy without any alcohol in my system. And I didn't think I was the kind of person that could do that. If anybody told me that, I would have said, you don't understand me. When I don't have any alcohol in my system, I'm miserable. I grew up in New England, in New Haven, Connecticut, and spent a lot of years in the Marine Corps, traveled around, but most of it was on the East Coast, and I ended up in Florida, so I'm pretty much an East Coast alcoholic. And as you all know, there's a big difference between East Coast and West Coast alcoholics. We throw up 3 hours earlier than you do. Other than that, I can't find any difference. Yeah, I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut. My parents were depression-oriented type people, and so they were very nervous about money, and my father had lost his first job when the stock market crashed, and but we still did well, definitely middle class, and they saved money, sent me to a nice prep school there in New Haven, and it funneled me right into Yale University. I graduated from there and ended up in the Marine Corps. So if you were to look at the just the paperwork record, you'd say, gee, this guy's going along great. But like the rest of you, when you look on the inside, you see a mess that is somehow managing to escape detection and is progressing along in his little life. But if you could get inside of my head, you would find that I've never felt like I even belonged on this planet. I just looked around and felt this sense of being different, being very uncomfortable. When I was little, I had polio. They had a big polio epidemic, and I can remember being sent off and into some home for crippled children, and we were sort of locked up in there, and nobody could get in there to visit us because they were worried about it spreading. And that was how I felt life was going to be, that you're going to be sitting around, and then they grab you, and you're going to be gone somewhere. And the church, I went to the Catholic Church, and for years I used to blame alcoholism on them. And then I got tired of that, so I blamed it on my parents. And I found that this is very common. We got to blame it on somebody. We're not going to take responsibility ourselves. And so basically I was just a skinny, nervous teenager wondering what was going on and pretending that I knew. When I entered the university, I had not had a drink. I was trying to be a good athlete and a good student, but it was very unusual to be in college and not to be drinking. And so people around me would go, you know, everybody's drinking. You ought to be starting. And, oh, I'm going to wait. And the first night that I drank, I talk about this in almost every talk because it just clarifies how rapidly I went from being a non-alcoholic to an alcoholic. It took about 15 minutes. And it was one of these events that I detested. I'm still not too fond of them, but it was basically the dean had put these names on a list, and it basically was, you 30 guys, go into this room tonight, a little social hour, and just meet each other. Just get to know each other. And that was like going into combat for me. Because when I walked in, I could see from the eyes, just those other 29 eyes just turned to me. And it was clear in their eyes that they did not want to know me. It was just as clear as a bell. And I always had to overcome that. So that night I was determined to go and meet these people. But the closer I got to each group, they had broken up into 6 and 5 and 3. And as close as when I would approach them, they would all turn and just glare. Like, we got enough friends. We don't want to know you. So I'd go over here. I'd go over here. I'd go over there. Never did meet anybody. Just couldn't stick my hand out. There was a bar in there, and I went up to the bartender, and I said, well, maybe tonight I'll have a drink. I just feel so much pressure. My roommate said it makes you feel good, so I'm going to see if I can feel good. So I ordered some whiskey and soda, something like that, and I remember tasting it, and I thought it tasted awful. But I drank it anyway. Waited about 5 minutes, and I don't recall feeling great. So I ordered another one. I sat around talking to the bartender, drinking this drink, waiting to feel great, and nothing happened, so I ordered a third one. I got about halfway through the third one, and I decided that the stuff didn't work. So I put the glass down and decided to leave, but as I started leaving, I looked back into the room, and those 30 mean guys were gone, and they had been replaced by 30 of the friendliest people I've ever seen in my life. Just by looking at their eyes, I could tell they all wanted me as their best friend. They were begging me to come over to their group. Please join our group. Please join our group. And I'm looking at this, and I never felt so wanted in my life. It was just wonderful. And then I felt a little different. I had sort of a taller stature, and I was sort of just, yeah, you know. And I had the feeling they'd be lucky to know me. You know what I mean? That they were in for a big surprise. I was on my way over to talk to them. So what happened was, I was transformed into a new world. That's what alcohol did. It took the old world that was so intimidating and threatening, and it became a wonderful world. As I was going over to talk to these guys, I remember saying to myself, you should have started drinking in second grade. Just think how it would have been through all those years and family get-togethers and everything. I mean, this stuff is amazing. And I went around and I intuitively knew how to handle situations that used to baffle me. I had no regrets about anything. I was totally spontaneous, creative. And it was almost like I was now operating at 100%. Because those fears and anxieties would just shut me down so that I couldn't function with whatever capacity I had. And now suddenly, I was totally me. And I could be funny. I could be creative. I could just do all these things. There was no restraints anymore. And I loved it. And later that night, I was vomiting all over the place, and the bed is spinning, and never felt so sick in the morning. I had the worst headache I've ever had. I just was retching and dying. And I remember saying to myself, this is a small price to pay for what you had last night. It wasn't even close. It wasn't even close. I knew that I had found the secret for my life. And boy, that's a long way to go in just 1 hour drinking. All the way to, this is the secret. This is the power that will get me through any situation for the rest of my life. All of that happened just in the first night of drinking. And I'm an alcoholic. And of course, that became the center focus of my life until I got to AA. And the rest of life was sort of just something that was going on in the background. And to me, that's alcoholism. It becomes the central focus. It is the answer to everything. And it's the power that would take and move me into a comfortable place. So from that day on, each day was divided into two parts. There was the part where you couldn't drink and go to school, or later on you have to go to work. And then there was the part when the day began around 5 o'clock when you could drink. And so the first part had nothing to do with life. I mean, that was just what you had to do to get it out of the way, to get drinking money. So you could go into the place at 5 o'clock and go into the magic world, and that's where I just wanted to live all the time. My grades started suffering, gave up athletics, I'm smoking about 3 packs a day, and I'm just looking forward to drinking. Somehow I managed to graduate with very low grades. It was probably as marginal as you can get. The Korean War had ended, but the draft was still on, and so everybody had to serve in the military. I hadn't planned, I didn't have any plan for myself. I'm still wondering what I want to be when I grow up. It's still a mystery to me. But here was this situation. We had to go down and pick one of the branches. Some guys were drinking beer, and they said, why don't we join the Marine Corps? I said, okay, Marines, that sounds great. And I actually showed up with golf clubs. If you're planning on joining the Marine Corps, I would not do that. Do not show up with golf clubs. And I can remember, I've been there about an hour, and I just remember saying to myself, man, these guys are intense. I mean, they're just too intense. Back off, guys. What it was like. It just was amazing. And I got further and further into it and eventually got to be commissioned, and then we were trained for 6 months to be a platoon leader. And that was very intense. And that's all I remember about all this. But man, this is just amazing. And I saw a training movie about pilots, and the pilots were at the bar in this training movie. And they were talking with their hands, and they were doing all this, and there were some blondes in the background, and they were lurking around. So I asked this major, I said, what's this pilot stuff over there? He said, oh, you don't want that. He said, you got to sign up for 3 more years if you want that pilot. I said, I'll sign up for 3 years. I don't have anything else going on. I just want to get out of this intensity level that's going on around here. So I sign up for flight school. And I graduated from basic school. And I had met this wonderful woman on one of my visits back up to New Haven to see some of my old buddies. And we fell in love, got married, and went off to flight school. And I got airsick on the plane on the way down to flight school. And I got airsick in the SNJ about the first 6 flights, and it looked like I was not going to be making any career out of flying. But turned out I ended up being, that was something that I took to naturally once I got over that motion sickness. And I became very good. And I was ended up flying for the Marine Corps for 14 years. And I was a fighter pilot, got promoted, made it through all these various schools. This wonderful woman and I, pretty soon we have 1 kid, and then 2, and 3, and 4, and 5, and 6. And I'm looking around, there's no room at the table to sit down, and it's like, man, it's getting crowded around here. And we're being transferred every year somewhere. The Marine Corps moves you around a lot, and those kids were in a different school all the time. But it was, in spite of all the drinking, there was still a lot of fun in the family. And we just kept on going. But my alcoholism was about to take over and cause a stop to all of the progress that had been somehow made. And there came a day when I was up at Cherry Point, North Carolina, and we were flying the F-8. I was in a photo squadron, and I started to experience for the first time withdrawal symptoms while flying. And it was very frightening. And we were going 12 hours without drinking before you fly. And that was the big mistake that I was making. Because that set me up for the withdrawals that were coming in, and I would start losing peripheral vision, then I would start sweating, then my heart would start racing, and I definitely had this craving, to drink, but you couldn't be drinking while flying. So I started to distrust the pilot of the plane that I was in, which was me. And it was, there was part of me that didn't want to go up with me because I knew, you know, what was really happening was I'm going, I think you hit this switch. I'm not sure. I think you do this. And you got to, you know, you're supposed to be sharp. Things happen fast. So I would be aware of all the little almost mistakes that were going on, but none of them ended up ever causing an accident or anything like that. So no one else knew this. They just said, hey, good job, good job. Oh, those are good photos. Yeah, good job. And I remember one time I was, the F-8, you had to lower the wing after you took off. It had a wing that went up and down, which was strange. And I accidentally hit the engine master switch during takeoff and shut the engine off and turned it back on, and it lit again. And I talked to a maintenance guy later. Hypothetically, if a guy ever turned the switch off, you know how you ask those questions? You know, you don't want to ever say that it really happened. And he allowed that it was like a one in a million shot the plane would restart under a situation like that. So that was the kind of stuff that I was aware of that was going on, and I kept it up for probably another 6 months. And there was just, it was just coming to an end where I just couldn't handle this. I used to, when I would fly, I would leave all my problems on the ground. You know, all the stuff, the money and the lies and all the stuff that was going on. I would be totally in the now. And now I was taking everything up and I was just a mess flying around. And so I did something that only on an emergency would I do. I went to a doctor and told him a few of these little stories that I wasn't feeling good and all that. And so they said, well, we're going to have to examine you very closely. And so I was sent down to Pensacola for 2 weeks to see what could have caused this. What is going on with this man? And at that point in time, there was no disease of alcoholism in the Navy. So you couldn't be an alcoholic. I mean, it was before, you know, the services got their alcohol program. And so they examined me and they found high blood pressure. My hands trembled. I was confused. I was covered with clammy sweat. My eyes were bloodshot. My voice shook, and I reeked of alcohol at all times. That was what they had to go on. And I remember the dentist, I never went to a dentist because they're right in your mouth. They can smell everything. And also, they want you to pick up a little cup full of water and rinse your mouth out. And I knew I couldn't get that cup from there to here. It would be all over the place. So I just never went to the dentist. Anyway, this guy smelled the alcohol. It was like, you know, 11 in the morning. He said, man, you just reek of alcohol. And I said, well, I drank all night. And he said, okay, well, that explained it. It was almost like if you hadn't been drinking and you reeked of alcohol, then we'd call in somebody that would have. So you can see there was nothing there, and so the psychiatrist, it was one of these big deals at the end of the thing. You sit in front of a board, and they said, well, the psychiatrist says that his testing of you indicates a childhood fear of flying that has just shown up after 12 years. Now, I knew that wasn't true, but I didn't have the courage to fight anything. I just went, and that was the end of me. That was my total identity. Now I'm not a fighter pilot anymore. I'm just a mess. And I came back, waited 3 months for the Marine Corps to reassign me. I was a career officer, and they have to give you a new specialty. And 3 months later, I got my orders to become an air traffic controller. So that was what... That was what they thought was appropriate for a guy that got in the shape I was in. And the amazing thing is I made it through that school, which is a very hard school. Anybody who's done air traffic control work, it's really hard. And somehow I got through that And then my last year drinking, I was over in Japan as the officer in charge of a little air traffic control unit. And when we went on deployment, we were the guys that set up the runway and brought in the planes. And the senior enlisted man took one look at me, "Welcome aboard, Captain. There's your coffee and there's your chair, but don't go near the radar." He knew that they did not want me personally controlling anything. And that year, my last year drinking, now I drank any time. So I drank around the clock. I got malnutrition, lost about 50 pounds, stopped hanging around with the guys. I didn't even go to happy hour. I was in a survival mode. I went to work and I went back to Quonset Hut and I tried to eat soup. And even that wouldn't stay down. So I'd drink grain alcohol and vodka and juice. That was what I was just surviving on. Made it through the year and came back to Quantico, Virginia to a career school, and that's where I had a grand mal seizure. Off to the hospital. What caused the grand mal seizure? Again, we start this whole charade. What could have happened to this guy? He must be studying too hard in the school. There's all these things for about 6 days, and then I went into DP. And people were coming in the room. The CIA was moving the walls, and they thought I was a spy, and they were... You know, everything was happening, so I freaked out and was screaming and doing stuff, and they put me in a straitjacket, and I was locked up in the nut ward for 6 months. So that was the, that was how they took care of that problem. And probably about 3 months in there, AA talked to the psychiatrist and said, you got alcoholics, we ought to bring one meeting in a week. And that's how I got to a meeting. And Corman said, "All drunks fall in, right face. I'm in a meeting." I thought it was great, but I didn't think it was for me. You know what I mean? I said, "Wow, these guys are great. It's exciting. If anybody, my friend, if I run into an alcoholic, I'm going to send them right over here to AA." So it really wasn't taking. And very briefly, at the end of, I think, 5 months, I was allowed to be an outpatient. They were going to send me back to duty, so I was home at night, but I was in the nut ward all day long, Monday through Friday, so I'm driving back and forth, and it was this Sunday, the Redskins were playing. I had a rule that you have to drink beer during the Redskin game. That's just a rule that I had, and I didn't want to sit there with the set off, you know, so... So I decided to have this beer, even though they told me if you ever have one more drink, your career is over. I said, well, what they meant if you get drunk and all that. So I drank the beer, watched the game, nothing happened, went to bed, never slept better. Back up to the nut ward, I felt wonderful. And I'm going, what about this first drink gets you drunk? You know, this is wonderful. And I remember feeling like, wow, I'm an ex-alcoholic. That was the... I figured there was some way to graduate beyond or whatever it was. And I had this freedom from alcohol, total freedom. I couldn't eat or sleep. I was so excited about this new freedom. And I just, it was all I thought about. Man, I had a beer and nothing happened. I had a beer and nothing happened. And it just kept me going all week. And I didn't eat or sleep over this new freedom from alcohol. So on the way home this next weekend, I decided if I can drink beer, I can drink vodka. So I bought a quart, and I thought it would be like a year's supply. I really believed that this would be on this new thing, and that was gone during the game. I'm bringing the vodka now back into the nut ward on Monday morning. I know they're going to catch me, and the following weekend, I joined AA on the outside. You know what I mean? I called Northern Virginia Intergroup, and the one guy that they got a hold of was the one guy from Quantico, who was another Marine captain, infantry guy, big, mean, and he came to my house and knocked on the door, and the door was shaking, and I opened the door, and no light came through the door frame, and he just came in and took over my life. This is a 12-step call. I talk, you listen. Sit down over there. Talk to my family. He didn't ask me anything. He asked the kids and my wife, what about him? Well, and they all made up a story that I was a terrible father and a terrible husband. told dastardly lies about me to him. He said, well, that settles that. Okay, we're going to a meeting. You know, get in the car, and off we went. And I haven't had a drink since. I just, this guy, and he's still my sponsor. You know, I mean, that's pretty amazing. You have the same sponsor for 36 and a half years. It's a wonderful thing. I'm very happy about that. And he started me down this wonderful path of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a lot of things have happened in that path. Sometimes I don't talk much about relationships, but I felt like talking a little bit about it tonight. This woman that I had married when I was young, I mean, we just fell in love. It was one of these love stories. And after 20 years of marriage, probably about 7 years of sobriety, we were just, the finances were so bad, and the stress with those six kids. I got thrown out of the Marine Corps, and I was trying to sell stuff, and I just couldn't get it going. And the stress was so bad that we ended up getting divorced. And she remarried, and I tried to find other wives that would take her place, and I would marry somebody for 5 years, and that wouldn't work out, and marry somebody else, and that wouldn't work out. And I remember after about... And then it took quite a few years for my children to get back where we are now, because they felt it was all my fault that this had split had occurred, and didn't want to talk to me. But then as the years went by, it all just started coming back. And they got closer and closer, and now I just feel like it couldn't be better. And I guess we've been apart about 10 years, and... I was talking to one of my daughters, and I said, you know, I still love your mother. And she said, well, she still loves you. And I went, oh, boy. And it's been about, I guess she's been married about 25 years. And I send messages through my kids that I still feel that way, and she sends it back. And I know that it's just going to be the way it is. And some of my children go, Dad, just take good care of yourself, and you can outlive him. So I'm very trim, and I work out, and I take a lot of vitamins, and I haven't given up. There was a, when I think about what my sponsor gave me, what he started me down on this road, is it all has to do with God. I mean, when you boil everything down about Alcoholics Anonymous, every single part of Alcoholics Anonymous has to do with God. If somebody were to ask me, well, what does step one have to do with God? How about step seven? God. How about 11? God. But it all has to do with God. That's the whole purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was thinking about, there's a sentence in the chapter of the Agnostic, a couple of sentences, and I'm going to paraphrase it. Well, I don't have to. There's a book right here. I'll read it. Thank you. This time I'll get it. I'll get the exact quote. If, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if, when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. And then comes the sentence. If that be the case, then you may be suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience will conquer. Now think about that definition of an illness. You have an illness that only a spiritual experience will conquer. Now, if you think about that, that's a rather unusual illness. You know what I mean? There's no therapy that's going to do this. There's no pill that's going to do anything. Only a spiritual experience. Well, what kind of an illness could that be? Did you ever think about that? Well, what is this illness? I thought it had to do with drinking. No, this has to do with a spiritual experience. And the more I think about that, I think about the early history of Alcoholics Anonymous. When Roland Hazard was sent to Dr. Young. And as you know the story, he was a very wealthy, the son of a very wealthy man, and his father wanted to take over the business, but he's a raving alcoholic, and he had tried everything in Dr. Young in Switzerland. And Roland went over there and spent a year, and Dr. Young tried to cause this personality transformation through his psychiatry. And he did the best that he could. At the end of that time, he said to Roland, "You understand your situation?" "Yes, I understand my situation." "Well, good luck. You're in the best shape I can get you in." And Roland made it as far as Paris on his way back. Somebody asked him the wrong question. They said, "Would you like a drink?" And he said, "Sounds good to me." And, of course, he just, boom, the disease took over and he was in terrible shape. So he went back to Dr. Young. He said, "I'm sorry, but look what happened to me." And then we have the world's greatest psychiatrist. You know, and I'm trying to tell this story so that we might feel the hand of God working all the way through this. Because here we have the world's greatest psychiatrist who has enough humility to say to Roland, "There's nothing I can do for you." And I feel that's that out of chapter 5, you know, there's no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. This was no human power. You can't go beyond that. This is it. You've now searched the world for any human help that's available, and that human help in its highest form has just said, "There's nothing I can do for you." And that sets up that absolute hopelessness that is so necessary for a personal transformation. And he went on to say, now there have been a few cases that I'm familiar with and I've read about where people have found a spiritual transformation. So if I was you, I would go try to have something like that happen. And of course, we all know that he found the Oxford movement. And it came to pass that he passed this word on to Ebbe when Ebbe was in jail and Roland went and got him out. And then Ebbe went and passed this on to Bill Wilson. And then Bill Wilson passed it on, and Dr. Bob passed it on to all you and I. And then a lot of years went by, and Bill realized that he never closed the loop with Dr. Young. And I think it was in the 60s. So he wrote him a letter, and he said, "You may not remember Mr. Hazard, but he came to see you in the early 30s, and you gave him this advice, and as a result of that advice, there's now this organization called Alcoholics Anonymous, and we just wanted you to know what a founding role you played in starting this organization." And it was lucky that Bill wrote it then, because it wasn't much longer after Dr. Young responded, and then he passed away. And his basic response was something along the lines of, "No, I didn't know what happened to Mr. Hazard, but it's very exciting to learn what has happened. As you know, I was trying to cause a spiritual transformation, but the field of psychiatry at that time, you weren't even allowed to talk about God, be laughed out of your profession. Now it's a little more open and we're more free to talk about that, but that's exactly what I was trying to do, was to have this spiritual transformation." And he went on to infer that the nature of the problem that alcoholics have is an inordinate longing for God. Now think about that in terms of our lives, and think about how easy it is to misdiagnose that. We don't know that it's an inordinate longing for God. It feels like we're just screwed up. That there's something missing. You know, I should be happy, but I'm not. I'm not comfortable. There's something wrong with me. You know, other people look more adjusted, and so on down. And so we get diagnosis, and we just go, "Well, I can tell what it is. I don't have enough money. I don't have a yacht. I don't have the right woman. I don't have enough sex. I don't have enough power. I got to be the president of the company." And all these roads are followed to one degree or another. And guess what? It's still there. It's still there. That empty feeling inside that has not yet been addressed. And the only thing that worked on that was alcohol. Alcohol was almost an equal to a spiritual experience. It was coming from the inside out. It was a power greater than ourselves, and it transformed the world that we lived in into a wonderful place. Everything looked different as a result of alcohol, as a result of the power of alcohol. It literally enabled us to see, as Chuck said, with a new pair of glasses. That's what alcohol for. When I looked at it this way, after three drinks, I would sit there going, I don't know what I was so upset about when I came in the bar. Everything's fine right now. Nothing had changed. Just some power had caused me to see everything differently. And I think the same thing happens as we work the steps. And to me, the steps are just a series of actions that I didn't believe in, but I took anyway because you talked me into it. And I remember studying those steps. I finally became convinced that they held the answer. And I went back and looked at them real serious. And I remember getting through the steps, and I didn't ask my sponsor, but I remember saying to myself, I still don't see the money step. I just don't see that in here. And that is the crux of the problem that I have, of these six kids and the bills, and I can't pay them all. I mean, it's causing all this pressure. And the steps are the answer. There's got to be a financial step in here. They must be disguising it somehow with something. And then there wasn't a relationship step. And there wasn't a power step. None of it made any sense. And the reason I'm bringing this out is, if you're new, they'll never make any sense by reading them. They'll only make sense if you do them. Because then the transformation starts taking place. When I think about what is transformed inside of me, I think about my character defect, and I always assumed I was my character defect. If you were to ask me who I am, I would just rattle off all my character defects, and that would be who I am. I'm a guy who can't stop doing this. I'm a guy who does this. And if somebody said that, I do this. I mean, that's who I am. And so when they came in here, well, let's see if we can get rid of your character defect, I said, well, I'll be no one. You know, I'll be the hole in the donut. Who the hell will I be with no character defects? What will I be? You ever wonder about that? If you had no character, what would you be? What would you stand around doing? I got no defects, but I must just stand here all the time then. I don't know. What do you do with no defects? You ever have that feeling like, you know, man, that could be weird, as I got thinking, you know. So as a result, I never really wanted them all gone. You really like that part. So what is it that is left if the character defects are going? You know what it is? It's the real us. This is the real person that's been inside all along. This is the spiritual entity that has been totally overlooked by all of the thinking that we assembled in our growing up period. And I got ideas from the church. I got ideas from the neighbors. I got ideas from bathroom walls. Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, wow, That's a tough one to think about. Wow. So I have a lot of truth that is racing around inside of me. And it was an old guy in Washington used to say, it isn't the things you don't know that'll kill you, it's knowing things for sure that just ain't so. And that's what we had. We had all kinds of things about the world and ourselves that just aren't true. But that's what was in my mind, and that's what constituted my reality. And so there had to come a time when I started seeing beyond that. And to me, that's what the steps had to do with. And I was talking about this the other night up in Las Vegas, that the beginning of it for many of us comes when we're maybe 3 months sober and we're sitting at a meeting and we see somebody in their first week come in. And we look over and this guy looks just like we did. I mean, he's looking around. His eyes can't focus. You know, they're looking this way, that way, and he really doesn't want to be here, and he's sweating and nervous, and they take him over to the coffee thing, tries to get some coffee, spills all over, so he doesn't have coffee, and he goes and sits down. And we're sitting there going, man, this is like a rerun of me 3 months ago. And part of us makes a connection with this person. We just sort of feel what they're feeling. And at the end of the meeting, we almost go up and say hello to them. Almost. But we're too new. We're not up to that yet. But we think about them during the week. And they're going, I hope that guy comes back to that group next week. I hope that guy comes back next week. And we come back next week, and he's not there. And about 10 minutes into the meeting, the door opens, and there he is. He's still sober. He looks better. He's not shaking as bad. He goes over the coffee pot. He gets a half a cup this time. Gets it to the seat, and you can see he's really pleased with himself getting that coffee all the way to the seat. And he's sitting there, and part of us on the inside goes, yay! And the question is, what is that? Who is yelling yay? Who is this self-centered person who never thinks about anybody but themselves that's yelling yay for this guy we haven't met yet? The answer to that is, that's the real you. That's the part that the program is going to reach in and pull out. That's what the steps are designed to remove, all of the phony part of us, all the stuff that isn't real, all the old ideas are stripped away until the real spiritual being is allowed to come out. And to me, the amazing thing that I had wrong, there's so many things that I had wrong about life, and one of them was that I needed things in order to fix what was wrong with me. That was what I just was always looking out there for something else to fix what was in here. And I didn't need anything except to give. I had it all backwards. I had the energy flow going the wrong way. I said, I'm going to need this. And none of that was true. What I needed to do was to open up the channel, as the prayer of St. Francis suggests, by working the 12 steps so that the true love and spiritual centeredness of myself and of all of us can flow out to other people. And once that started happening, I started realizing I would go home at night totally happy and satisfied with everything just the way it was. For me, that was an absolute miracle to find out that that's what it was all about. There was another thing that I wanted to read tonight. I came up against it earlier in the month. And it has to do with forgiveness. And I wanted to wrap up by talking a little bit about forgiveness. It's in May 3rd. In the little 24-hour book. I must overcome myself before I can truly forgive other people for injuries done to me. The self in me cannot forgive injuries. The very thought of wrongs means that myself is in the foreground. Since the self cannot forgive, I must overcome my selfishness. I must cease trying to forgive those who have fretted and wronged me. It's a mistake for me to even think about these injuries. I must aim at overcoming myself in my daily life, and then I will find there's nothing in me that remembers the injury, because the only thing injured, my selfishness, is gone. And I don't know if that's happened to you, where you decide to forgive someone, you go, you know, I'm going to forgive that person. But there's a whole part of you that isn't buying it. You know what I mean? You're going, okay, he's off the hook. But then when you rethink the injury, you know, there's like, well, down in here I haven't forgiven him, but I've said that, you know, and so it's almost like until I'm willing to forget about that, I'm going to work on this program of getting closer to my higher power, to get rid. Still an alcoholic, and thank you. Give me about 5 minutes more, and I will be finished. I wanted to finish this thing about forgiveness, and that is, I remember when I was growing up and I was studying the Bible and I'm reading about Jesus and all the things that are happening, and the only part I liked was when he turned the water into wine. I thought that was wonderful. And Then there was some other stuff I thought was cool and all that. And then all of a sudden, we're at this part where they're nailing him to a cross. And I'm going, this is almost a little too intense for me. I don't know if I like this part. And he says, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. And I remember going, hey, Jesus, are you on drugs? Do you see what's happening to you? They're nailing you to a cross. And I'm just going, how could he be forgiving that? But as I grew up and I started having it explained to me, that was sort of the bar. That forgiveness should be extended all the way up to and including being nailed to a cross. Now the funny thing is, all during my life I kept having things happening to me that were more serious than getting nailed to a cross. The reason they were more serious, because they were happening to me. Not to you, or not to Jesus, or not to anybody else. They were happening to me. And so I listed things that were just unforgivable. And that stuff that is carried around, you can carry stuff for years. And this program has enabled me, and a lot of the speakers we've already had have talked about this, of stuff that we just carried that was like nails that we had placed in ourselves. About events that couldn't be forgiven. And I realize now that the faster I can get rid of anything, I love that part where it said, the only thing that can get injured is my selfishness. That's the only thing. So anytime I feel that I've been wrong, myself has gotten in the way. My ego is the only thing that can get hurt. Remember the first time I heard when they said self-centeredness at the root of our problem, I remember saying, well, I'll fix that. I'll take care of that, and I'll just stop being self-centered. Me, I'll stop being self-centered. You ever try and figure out what the opposite of self-centered is? What is it, unself-centered? Doesn't make sense. Turns out, God-centered is the only answer to self-centeredness. And it's the real center. And every time when I get disturbed, as the 10th step talks about, my primary goal is to get undisturbed. That's the point of sobriety, is to stay as undisturbed and to get undisturbed as soon as possible, so that the person that I bring into my daily life is undisturbed. When I bring that person into my daily life, I treat you all different than when I'm disturbed. I am in harmony with you. My spiritual part can love you. I can just walk in and have a smile. My eyes show that I'm not hurting from some self-centered, imagined wound. And when I treat the world that way, it treats me back that way. And we literally transform the world by changing the inside of ourselves. As a self-centered, practicing alcoholic, we brought out the worst in everybody that we met. And think about that. You're seeing people always at their worst. And we come home and go, this world is rotten. I mean, everybody today was a complete, and little did I know that I was bringing that out in people. My parents were having their 50th wedding anniversary. My sister had the list. There was one person I just didn't want her to invite because he was just so obnoxious. And I remember telling her, and she had 20 years in the program at the time. I said, do we have to invite him? He gets this and that and that. And she said, he only does that when you're around. What? Yeah, he only does that when you're around. And so I went and treated him as my sister said he was. Just went up, Uncle John, how are you? Good to see you. And he was great. He was absolutely great. I was totally wrong what he was. So I guess what I'm saying, if you're new, is you have the opportunity in here, under the guidance of your sponsor and the wonderful literature that we have, to transform the world that you live in so that there will be no reason to drink. That's what sobriety is. There's nothing for alcohol to fix. And when there's nothing for alcohol to fix, it's real easy to stay sober. Thank you very much.
Thanks, buddy. Thank you.